Hey, J-Ro Show listeners. By now, you're probably familiar with the all-in-one investing platform, Public.com. Public recently launched options trading, and if you activate by March 31st, you can earn a lifetime rebate of 18 cents on every contract traded. That can add up to hundreds, even thousands of dollars in savings. Plus, unlike other investing platforms, Public doesn't charge commissions on per contract fees. So that's no commissions, no per contract fees, and a rebate of 18 cents on every contract traded. Discover the most cost-effective way to trade options and start getting something back on every contract, every trade. It only takes a couple of minutes to sign up at public.com. Paid for by Public Investing. Must activate options account by March 31st for revenue share. Options not suitable for all investors and carry significant risk. Full disclosures in podcast description. U.S. members only.
Welcome to The J-Ro Show. On this podcast, your host, John Rotondi, interviews experts in and outside the world of investing. The J-Ro Show dives deep into what it takes to achieve mastery and sustain top-level performance. As a quick reminder, this podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. All opinions expressed by John or any of his podcast guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. Now please enjoy this episode.
I'm John Rotondi, and this is The J-Ro Show, a podcast that explores what it takes to achieve mastery, sustained performance, and longevity. The show hopes to uncover the processes, structures, frameworks, and mindsets that professionals put in place to maintain winning performance in their respective fields. Today, I am joined by Wynn Murray. Wynn is the Director of Research at Diamond Hill. Prior to joining Diamond Hill, he worked at Harris Associates for 18 years, where he also served as the Director of U.S. Research and was a co-portfolio manager on the Oakmark Select Fund. Wynn is a master of research process and analyst training and development, and having worked as a Director of Research at two of the most storied value investing firms, I can think of almost no one better to discuss equity research process in all of its facets. Wynn, welcome to the J-Ro Show.
Thanks, John.
So, Wynn, tell us about Diamond Hill.
Yeah, Diamond Hill is a $30 billion, in terms of assets, value investing shop in Columbus, Ohio. They have the preponderance. We have the preponderance of our assets in U.S. equities, from large cap all the way down to small cap. We have an international equity fund. We have a long short product, and we have a fixed income, a couple of fixed income funds as well. But the philosophy underpinning all of the Diamond Hill funds, regardless of asset class or geography or market cap, is to purchase our investments when they are trading at a discount to their intrinsic value. So it's a philosophically pure shop. It does not have a lot of contrasting styles that need to be serviced by the research department. And quite frankly, I think we invest the only way that, you know, is mathematically sound, and math is undefeated. So I feel pretty good about our investment philosophy.
Wynn, I love that. You're a Diamond Hill is a philosophically pure intrinsic value investing firm, and math is undefeated. That's actually one of my favorite new quotes. I love that. And then I'll just say quickly, I've heard that Columbus, I've never been, but I've heard it's sort of like the Austin of Ohio, like kind of good food, good coffee shops, good music scene, really good place to live.
Well, so, I mean, if there's going to be an Austin of Ohio, it is going to be Columbus. I think I think more broadly, if you think about pattern recognition, you know, what are some of the characteristics of Austin? It's got the largest university in the state. It's the state capital. It's got a very convenient airport right next to downtown. The population's growing rapidly, tech money coming in. It's a very blue city in a reddish state. So it has some tax advantages. I think Columbus checks every one of those boxes. I think that it is, 15 or so years behind Austin in terms of its development. But it certainly, I would not have taken this job if I thought it was difficult to recruit to Columbus. And before taking this job, I cannot say that I had ever given Ohio much thought. And when I had, my visceral reaction was not, oh wow, cool Ohio. And I have been super pleased with how dynamic Columbus is, and have been able to recruit people to Columbus who have moved from other cities and moved their family here without feeling like that I've bait and switched them. You know, I think it is legitimately a place that people would be happy to live in.
Wynn, that sounds like a quite lovely place to live. And I love how you tied it to recruitment as the director of research at Diamond Hill. And we are definitely going to get into recruitment later on in this interview. Wynn, let me ask you. So you are a great analyst and investor. You've worked with great analysts and investors, and you've trained great analysts and investors. So what qualities and skill sets do you think great equity analysts have? What can a great analyst do that maybe less experienced or less skilled analysts can't do as well?
So I appreciate the lead into that question. It was very complimentary. I will say that I'm very good at identifying talent. Mm-hmm. I don't think that training people to be a great investor when they have latent talent is one of my strengths. I actually believe that this is a tail of the bell curve industry, and really great talent has strengths and weaknesses that does not look like itself. If you mm-hmm. if you got 5 to 10 great analysts together, pushing them into a formal kind of training when they are young might actually break some of what makes them great. And I think that if you have middle of the bell curve talent, I think training them into processes that produce good outcomes is important. But in the top decile of talent, I think you actually do not want to standardize the way that they do things. So I will push back a little bit on having trained a lot of great investors. I've identified mm-hmm. a lot of great investors, and I've put them in a position where they are likely to succeed with good processes, good resources, a good philosophy, surrounded by other smart people.
That makes sense.
To your question, so if you think about the skills that a great analyst has versus an average analyst, I think at the foundational level, everyone needs to have a good understanding of accounting, and they need to have an intuitive understanding of numbers. But that does not mean that they're going to be successful. It's just, you know, if you wanted to be the best clarinet player in the world, you have to know how to read music. But if you know how to read music, it does not mean you're going to be the best clarinet player in the world. It's just a prerequisite to having the opportunity to be great. So all analysts start, you know, that are at least moderately successful, have a good grasp intuitively of accounting and numbers. I think the outstanding ones do a wonderful job of isolating the critical component of each differentiated investment idea. The less outstanding ones will throw a lot of facts at you, but will require you to discover the real core of the investment. The amount of data that anyone has at this point in time in the industry is overwhelming, and the preponderance of it is not relevant. And the younger analysts, of course, are going to consume a ton of this data, the more inexperienced analyst, and that makes a lot of sense because this is how they're learning. And the best ones will quickly see the only thing that matters is X and a little bit of Y. And some of the others are going to equal weight every letter of the alphabet and present it to you that way. And that is, you get better with that over time, but really great investors demonstrate that skill very early in their careers.
When that was fascinating, I've heard from a few really smart investors that what you just said, that great analysts can identify the 2 to 3 key drivers of an investment thesis. But then you took it one step further and said, those analysts that can't do that yet, and those analysts that just equally weight every letter of the alphabet, that forces the decision maker, the portfolio manager, to get to the crux of the thesis on his or her own. And so you took it that next step further and made it so clear about where and how a great analyst can add value. So what's
interesting about that is if you've identified the right portfolio managers and they are intuitively really good at finding the crux of an investment, and the best ones tend to be really good at that, it means that the analysts that are not good at it but do honest work and understand accounting and understand math and are valuing companies with a consistent process, these are not valueless analysts. These analysts actually bring value to the table in as much as they are producing an opportunity set that helps the portfolio managers make decisions. The issue just is that the work they're producing requires extra work to be layered on top of it to find, whether it's a great investment idea or not. And so it makes that analyst less valuable, but not valueless, because they still are producing good, honest work. It's just you're getting fewer epiphanies, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And I appreciate you highlighting that. And I really think that a lot of my listeners on this show are going to appreciate that as well. The work, when it's honest and rigorous, is not valueless. I really appreciate that, Wynn. So let's dive in a little bit to the investing team dynamics at Diamond Hill. So how many people are on the Diamond Hill investing team, and how do you think about team size or capacity? Is there do you measure team size relative to something, relative to AUM, or team size relative to the number of strategies or funds, or team size relative to the number of stocks owned? And when do you know when you were understaffed or fully staffed? And this is a multi-pronged question. Under what circumstances does hiring become a priority for a director of research?
So that question is practically its own podcast. And it is audience that will get a ton of value from this answer, I will say. I mean, you know, I can talk about this kind of thing all day long.
That's why I love talking with you. Yeah.
But the applicability of this answer to most people's workflow is tangential at best. So first of all, the team, so let's take fixed income out of it and let's just look at equities, domestic and international. Mm-hmm. We have 8 or 9 portfolio managers or assistant portfolio managers, and we have around 22 analysts.
That feels like a pretty deep team to me.
Yeah. So you ask, how do you know what the right number of analysts is? Yeah. So let's do an exercise here. Let's say you have a 50 stock portfolio, mm-hmm. and that you have 30% annual turnover. So you are going to need 15 new stock ideas over the course of a year. Let's also say that you only purchase half of the ideas that your analysts present to you. You're not forced to buy everything that you're shown, but you consider them, and on average, you buy about half of them. Mm-hmm. You're going to need to see 30 ideas to properly run your portfolio at its current level of turnover. If the typical analyst produces 3 ideas a year, then we've defined your capacity needs as 10 people. For that fund. As you add more funds, you do not have to do that same exercise all over again because there's overlap. So the long side of our long short product has significant overlap with many of our other funds. And so incrementally, it doesn't need a lot more capacity on the long side. But on the short side, it has a unique portfolio that's relatively high turnover and does require dedicated capacity. Same thing as you go down cap, the smaller cap you get, the more people you will need to add because the overlap with some of the other products is not the same. And of course, international is its own animal. But you can basically do this exercise with a range of expected turnover in the fund, with a range of productivity estimates per analyst, and with a range of percentage of ideas purchased that are shown to you, to kind of gauge when are you probably understaffed relative to the performance that you want to produce for your clients. And so I always know those numbers. And so every quarter, the new turnover data comes out and and it's lumpy but you're squinting at it and you're basically just making sure that everyone is properly resourced and that the clients who've chosen to invest with you are getting the quality work that they are essentially paying for and that they expect from you. What part of that question did I not answer?
You answered it all. And, I was hoping that you would put some numbers behind it, and I know how mathematical of a person you are, so I really appreciate that. The one thing I had not thought about fully was if you have a 50 stock portfolio and you have 30% turnover, then you need 15 new ideas. I mean, you need 15 new positions in a year, but the portfolio manager is not going to put every stock pitch into the portfolio. They're most likely, on average, maybe only going to choose half of those. And so if you need 15 new positions, you really need 30 new ideas. Well, and I don't think I had taken it that step further.
And that's the statistic that gets kind of force flexed, because if you don't have enough analysts, the portfolio manager is essentially forced to either dramatically lower the turnover of the fund or buy more of what they see. Right. And I tell my analysts, if we increase our productivity, it does not mean that the funds are going to increase their turnover. It means we're going to get fewer names purchased, but we're going to have better client outcomes because we are showing the portfolio managers a broader opportunity set. And so just because we didn't buy this name that you brought does not mean that it wasn't as valuable as the name that we did purchase, because you helped us define the best stock that we didn't currently own, even if it wasn't the one you brought. It added information. And so
I love that. Analyst productivity leads to a broader opportunity set. That leads to a better way of thinking about opportunity cost and rank ordering the ideas, which leads to better client outcomes.
Love so it. If you're running a 50 stock portfolio, you always need to know what the 51st best idea is. Right. And you probably need to know the 50th best idea as well. So you have a stock in your portfolio that is trading at the smallest discount to its intrinsic value currently, and it's the sale it's the very first sale candidate. And so if all you know are the four companies that were brought in the past 3 months by the research department, your decision making is not going to be nearly as strong as if you know the 28 companies that the research department brought over the past 4 months as you're identifying that 51st best idea.
Absolutely. Yeah. All makes perfect sense. You've worked at Harris Associates, where the analysts are all generalists, and now at Diamond Hill, which I think has more of a specialist model. So can you please walk through what you believe are some of the advantages and disadvantages of a strictly generalist or specialist approach?
Yeah, and first of all, I will say that there is no obvious correct way to structure a research department. Dodge & Cox, a world-class value investing shop, has sector analysts. And Harris Associates, a world-class value investing shop, has generalists. I don't think you can say, obviously, one of these models is superior. They do have
Capital Group. With its pedigree is also a sector model, I believe.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Diamond Hill generally has sector analysts. I think that there are certain segments of the market in which generalists are disadvantaged. I think that pharma and biotech, I think oil and gas, E&P companies, I think banks and insurance, maybe the semiconductor cap equipment cycle. I think there are some areas of the market where the learning curve is very steep. Mm-hmm. The accounting is very wonky, and the advantages that an experienced analyst has in that space with all of the people they know and all of the sector knowledge that they have, is obvious. I do think, though, that there's a whole bunch of the rest of the market that basically are just income statement companies. You got your revenue, cost of goods sold, SG&A, interest expense, taxes, profits, cash flow, capital allocation. And regardless of how that revenue is generated, whether it's software, or whether it's retail, or whether it's industrials or whatever, by and large, a good analyst is capable of doing income statement analysis and is of understanding the competitive dynamics of each of these industries without having to spend years trying to figure the industry out. And so in the income statement parts of the market, I think that generalists are not disadvantaged and many times can have pretty unique epiphanies about the cadence of cash flows and patterns that they've seen before in other segments of the market that a strict sector specialist might not be bringing to the table. I also think that in general, generalist shops, it's easier to produce portfolio management talent from a generalist shop because it's difficult to say, all right, my best analyst is my consumer staples analyst. Let's make them a portfolio manager now and hope that they can compare Pfizer to CarMax to Citigroup, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I Diamond Hill is a sector shop, and I think that in general, our experienced industry analysts add good value to our clients and to our process. But one of the things that I am doing here is on the margin, especially for the income statement companies, I'm softening the sector walls so that if an analyst happens to be a consumer staples analyst, and consumer staples, which is a pretty it's a sector that tends to correlate to itself pretty well and to fixed income. If his sector is not terribly attractive, rather than bringing the most attractive name in an unattractive sector, which does not compete well with what portfolio managers are seeing, I want these analysts to have the ability to say, you know what, I'm going to look at this, you know, this transportation company or this auto parts company or this retailer, and the analysts are excited about this. Like, this is not something where people are stepping on each other's toes. There are a lot of companies out there, and nobody can say with confidence that they have an updated estimate of value for an entire sector currently. And so having that ability to float a little bit under the surface, I think, will both help us develop new portfolio management talent and help the analysts develop pattern recognition skills that will make them better at picking stocks across the board.
I mean, that sounds like a very exciting development, and I look forward to watching how that process rolls out over time.
The other aspect of this is, you know, by definition, at a sector shop, your clients are exposed to your worst analyst, you know, because if you're a strict sector shop and every name is essentially assigned to somebody, then the portfolio managers are relying upon, by definition, whoever your worst analyst is, to give them advice in a certain sector, or they've chosen to ignore that analyst and they're having to put time into it themselves. You know, Dodge & Cox gets around this by having their worst analyst be well above the hurdle that you would apply to research analysts, such that there's no real identifiable weak link. But it is something that generalist shops do not run into, because the worst analyst at a generalist shop just does not get their names purchased and eventually becomes irrelevant to the research process without exposing client assets to their work, if that makes sense.
That's a fascinating point. At a strict sector specialist shop, your clients are exposed to your weakest analysts. You know, I suppose that means that if, you know, for example, just as an example, if semicap equipment stocks have broadly sold off and could potentially be very attractive, but your semicap equipment analyst, this is just an example.
Yeah, sure.
At a hypothetical firm is less experienced or less skilled, then that could be a real weakness at just the time when that shop potentially wants to add some exposure to semicap equipment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I think it's especially important to make sure, as director of research of a sector shop, that the clients are getting great research across the board, and that there aren't blind spots. Like the example you gave, I like a lot, because it's not that somebody was bringing bad ideas; it's that you had an error of omission by not having somebody ready to go with a lot of knowledge in that space. So that's just part of the job, and done properly, I think a sector shop can produce and does produce really, really great outcomes, but you have to be cognizant of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. At a high level, Wynn, what do you think should be included in a comprehensive equity research process from the point of idea generation to the point where the stock is pitched to the investing team? What steps should the analyst take in that research process?
So there are a lot of things that you could put in that list. You've got, the investor presentations, talking to the management team. You've got conferences. You've got building models. You've got talking to competitors and customers. You've got your expert networks. Et cetera, et cetera. But if you flip the question around and say, if an analyst didn't do one of these things in their process, it's obvious that they could not bring a new idea. The main ones are reading the SEC filings. I can't fathom somebody bringing a new idea without having gone through the Ks and the Qs. Building a model. I really cannot imagine somebody pitching a new idea without being able to show mathematically the cash flows that are expected to be produced and what they're worth. So I, at its core, the output that you're producing has to be able to show that the equity is mispriced. And the only way to show an equity is mispriced is to understand the business well enough to convince us that your valuation, which is different than what the market is applying to this stock, is correct. And so if you haven't read the K and you haven't built a model, you are going to fail at that. Now, if you have not talked to somebody in an expert network or you have not talked to the management team, it's not necessary that it's not, we don't have to assume that that means you're going to fail at this presentation. Each idea has its own workflow based on what you need to do to get confident that you have found a mispriced security. So again, I'm very hesitant to prescribe a checklist of things that I want to make sure you've done because that's going to make us worse. It's going to take our very best people and force them into a process that might not be right for them, and it's going to take every idea and treat it as if it's a tax audit or something like that. We and so it's difficult to say.
I love how you inverted that question. What steps in the process cannot be substituted? What steps in the process are absolutely critical to finding out how money flows through the income statement and then through the cash flow statement and whether the opportunity is mispriced or not? And those are reading the SEC filings and building that model. Wow, love that. Invert, always invert. So after an analyst has gone through their research process, and after they have built the model and successfully pitched the stock, and after the stock has made it into the portfolio, what does the ongoing coverage process look like? What is expected of an analyst when covering a stock once that stock has made it into the portfolio?
So the base expectation is that if we open your model, if a portfolio manager wants to see your thoughts on the company, that they are updated. And so after the name has been pitched, you may have had $100 per share intrinsic value. Every single day, news comes out. Now, most of it is irrelevant. It's highly unlikely you'd be making daily changes to your model. And if you did, I'd have a zillion questions for you about philosophy. But there are things that occur in terms of news flow that do change your estimate of value. And I need all the analysts to have incorporated all of their current thoughts in their intrinsic value estimate. Otherwise, if a portfolio manager opens it up and makes a decision to buy or sell a stock, and then the analyst says later, "Oh, I'm sorry, I hadn't updated my numbers yet for that analyst day," that's bad.
That's a booger. Yeah,
And so,
that's yeah.
yeah,
Whoops.
and yep, and that's an unforced error. So
Yeah.
the base expectation is that you always have an updated estimate of what the company is worth. Now, when you make changes to your estimate of what the company is worth, if you're changing it by 0.7% because of a tiny thing that you found that you want to do differently with the working capital, fine. That doesn't warrant a note letting us know. But if you're changing your estimate by 8% because of something you learned about the competitive environment or, you know, a new product or something like that, the expectation is also that then you write a little couple paragraphs basically saying, I'm updating my estimate of value for this company, and here's the rationale behind it, and here's the walk of where it was before to where it is now. Many, you know, you create your own maintenance work when you bring a new idea. Mm-hmm. If you bring a new idea and everything works perfectly according to your thesis, it's not a lot of work. If you bring a new idea and everything completely falls apart, you've made a lot of work for yourself. And all of us have done this, where we brought a new idea and we were confident it would work, and then the bad quarters started coming out, and the bad M&A started being done, and next thing you know, you're spending half your time trying to figure out this company that you brought as a new idea. You know, you can be your own arsonist basically with your coverage list, and in theory, it's your new idea production that produces the workflow for yourself in terms of your maintenance. And so when you say, how many names can an analyst follow, for instance, which is a question I get a lot, I think the answer is around a dozen, but it really depends on the sector and the analyst. And, you know, some people have more work with a 4-stock coverage list than somebody with a 16-stock coverage list because of the nature of what they brought.
Hi, JRO Show listeners. If you were to ask me for 3 features I'm looking for in a stock research platform that I live in every day, I'd say institutional quality data, alternative data and KPIs, and quick and easy robust charting functionality. FinChat.io has all of that. I use FinChat, I love it, and it has quickly become my go-to data source for my stock research. I think of FinChat as a complete stock research platform for fundamental investors. The platform has a beautiful design and institutional quality data, so it is incredibly powerful and easy to use. Beyond having all the standard financial data for companies around the globe, FinChat has company-specific segments and KPIs on over 1,500 stocks. Want to see Home Depot's average ticket price or sales per square foot? Are you curious about United Rentals' number of locations, market share, or fleet original equipment cost? Well, FinChat tracks all those KPIs and literally 500,000 more. And if you aren't sure where to go, simply ask FinChat. With FinChat's conversational AI, you can save tons of time researching stocks. FinChat also has a DCF modeling tool, a robust screening tool, 10 plus years of conference call transcripts, and also hedge fund letters, consensus estimates, and tons more. To get 25% off any paid plan, go to finchat.io/JRO. That's finchat.io/JRO. The link will also be in the show notes. Analyst productivity is such a fascinating topic and something that we've talked about so far today. So you said that analysts should on average maybe have the capacity to cover 12 stocks. About how many new ideas do you think a good analyst can be expected to pitch each year?
So I think an annual quota for new ideas is a bad process. Mm-hmm. Because you really don't know which ones are going to be great ideas when you start working on them. Right. This would be like going to Merck and saying, hey, why don't you scientists only work on the drugs that are going to be approved? You know, I mean, like, right. You don't know. You're doing a lot of research. Only bring the stocks that are going to go up. Why don't you? You know, yeah, sure. Okay. Thanks for the advice. Right. I think that you can have a period of time where you do a lot of work on a lot of names and they all die on the vine. you've built a knowledge base that will help you bring new ideas in the future, but it didn't actually lead to any new ideas right then. I prefer to kind of think of workflow over a five-year period, and I would say that over any given five-year period, I would think that most analysts would have brought, you know, between like 14 and 20 new ideas, something like that. So, you know, 3 to 4 a year. Mm-hmm. But if you really shot for 4 a year and then you broke it down and said, I'm going to do 1 a quarter, you're going to get bad outcomes.
Sure.
An interesting unintended consequence of this process is that your best analysts, the most productive analysts that produce the best work, are going to end up with the largest coverage lists, because more and more of their names are going to get bought and they're going to have more and more stocks to follow. And so they may have a 14, 16 stock coverage list. And now your best analyst does not have as much time to find new ideas.
Wow.
And meanwhile, yeah, your worst analyst, your least productive analyst, has the smallest coverage list, and they have the most amount of time to find new ideas. And this is not what your clients should want. And so you should have a process in place to transfer coverage of existing names to your less experienced analysts, your senior research associates, for instance, to give them practice covering stocks that we know well, that the senior analyst is right there and he also knows them well, but the names get transferred to you and you assume coverage of them and you learn them more and more as you're at that stage of your career. We build your coverage list through these adoptions. And meanwhile, then the experienced analyst gets time freed up to go out and search for new names. I think it's important to have that mechanism in place, or else you end up with a weird batch of time management that actually starts producing worse ideas. And this isn't necessarily your worst analyst, it's your least productive analyst, and they mm-hmm. tend to be your younger analyst. And so it's not that they can't do great work, it's just that it's a bad system that gives them so much free time to find new ideas compared to the experienced people.
Such a thoughtful way of thinking about how your most senior productive analysts end up with the most stocks in the portfolio, which means they have the largest coverage list and maintenance list, which leaves them less time for new idea generation, which is a skill set that they excel at. And so you transfer some of that coverage to less experienced analysts to open up time for them to find those new ideas. Wow, I love it. What do you expect to hear in a good stock pitch, Wynn?
So I want to hear why the market is giving us this opportunity.
Right.
You're basically telling us in a stock pitch that the market is wrong, and you're trying to show us that the market's opinion of this company has resulted in a mispricing. And you know, generally speaking, the market is not stupid. Mm-hmm. And so I want to understand, why are we getting this opportunity? And there's a lot of reasons why we might be. You know, it could be that this is a cyclical company and people are worried about a recession and they have a shorter time horizon than we do. And so they are handing it to us at a very low multiple of normalized earnings. Okay, I can buy that. It might be that this company has been mismanaged for 20 years and everybody thinks it's an 11% margin company, but a new CEO has come in and peers in the industry earn 18% margins. And we believe that the earnings are going to get much better. But the market is either complacent about the idea or they think it's a show me story. So that could be it. It might be as simple as a multiple expansion story, because for whatever reason, this type of company in the market right now has been abandoned. I don't love multiple expansion stories, but you can convince me that that's your thesis, especially if you're supporting it with private market transactions that demonstrate the private market value of the company. What I don't want to see is a report on how great the company is. It is much easier to identify a great company than it is to identify a great investment idea.
Absolutely. Yes.
And if your thesis is that everybody thinks this is amazing, but I think it's even more amazing, that is a tough thesis to prove. And I have not had great experience with the market being incredibly excited about something, but that they should be even more excited about it. Like that, the burden of proof is on the analyst there that the company is mispriced.
Right.
And so when I'm interviewing candidates, especially younger candidates, and they pitch a stock to me, all the time what they're doing is they're pitching a company to me, mm-hmm. and they're explaining how well positioned this company is and their new products and their and this, that, and the other, but they don't tie it into the opportunity and what the market is misperceiving. And that's the critical part.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. I want to get to the, I want to get down to like what communication skills analysts should have. So what type of deliverables do you think analysts should be able to provide? I mean, you mentioned a model and you mentioned writing up a couple paragraphs for the maintenance work. Is PowerPoint, do you see that as an important skill as well? So basically writing, putting together slides and then doing the work in Excel. Are those the three main sort of communication tools that you think analysts should use?
I think that PowerPoint skill is inversely correlated with investment acumen. If somebody's bringing a PowerPoint with their new idea presentation, I'm already worried. You should be able to write the thesis up in about three pages. And the first page, if I tore it off and only read it, I should basically get 85% of it. Yep. If you're going to an eighth page, or if you've put 20 slides together or something like that, you are essentially insulting the reader. You are basically telling the reader, I don't expect that you took the time to read the 10K. I don't expect you took the time to run the numbers yourself, to read the conference call transcripts, to look at the, I mean, you're presenting to experienced investors. And if you
Who are expected to go into the meeting having done work on the name.
Yes. Yes. If the analyst is presenting as if the audience doesn't know what the company does, and is educating them from scratch by including a whole lot of slides from the company's analyst day or discussion from the 10K, then, I mean, and maybe at some firms you need to do that because the portfolio managers have offloaded that responsibility to the analyst and they expect the analyst to educate them on everything. But the places that I've worked, and I think the places with portfolio managers who have as a class of people, some of the least amount of patience with bureaucracy and stupid meetings of any class of people that I've ever met. The idea that you are presenting that much is anathema to them. Like it's so I, you know, and the old joke, you know, I didn't have time to write a 3-page memo, so I wrote a 10-page one. It actually is a challenge to distill the investment into a small amount of output. And I think it's an important skill because I think it helps hone in on what we talked about up front, which is the one of the most critical things about being an analyst is to identify the two or three main factors in the investment. And by restricting how much you can produce in terms of output, you make it much harder for them to show you the 25 irrelevant things.
Once a stock has been pitched, what questions do you think a portfolio manager should ask after the pitch has been completed? What sort of follow-up questions is a portfolio manager trying to get more light on?
I mean, it really depends on the company, but at its heart, we're trying to get at the durability and forecastability of the cash flows. And as important, how they're going to be allocated, because you can produce a lot of cash flow, and if you set it on fire, it's not worth much. And so I think, generally speaking, the best portfolio managers, all of their questions have at their root trying to better understand how confident are we that these forecasts are going to come true? What's the range of possible outcomes around that? And if the forecasts are right, how do we benefit from the cash flows that the company generates? And so, you know, it really depends on the company, but I think that most good questions have those concepts at their heart.
What skills should a new associate hire have on day one? Is it you mentioned earlier, understanding of accounting and modeling. Are those two sort of table stakes skills that a new associate should have?
So they need to understand accounting. Accounting is taught at every college in the country. It is a waste for an intern to come in without knowing how the financial statements fit together, because then half the internship is being spent teaching something that is taught at every undergraduate university in the country. So you want to build on the accounting. Being able to build models at the intern level, and I'm thinking about interns because they're the stepping stone to associates. Sure. So when you say a new associate, I'm thinking an intern kind of. Building models is not something that's taught in school. And if you know accounting, then it's up to us to provide you with the templates and the rationale behind how models work and why they're important to figuring out what a company is worth. And so numeric literacy is very important, because you're going to build a big spreadsheet and you're going to have a couple errors in it. Mm-hmm. And you don't know where the errors are. All you get is a number at the end. And if you've reversed the sign on your working capital or something like that, which is a very sure. easy thing to do, you're going to get a wonky outcome. And the people who are numerically literate will look at that and say, that can't be right. And they'll find an error. And the people who aren't will look at it and say, well, there's what the spreadsheet's telling me, and they'll just run with it. And so there needs to be a sort of a mathematical common sense that's difficult to develop if somebody doesn't already have it, but it's not a super scarce trait to look for. Otherwise, that's kind of it. And I will tell you something that I do not require that many directors of research that I talk to think is critically important. I do not require a pre-existing passion for investing. Mm-hmm. I actually believe that the only undergrads who come in at age 18 or 19 with a passion for investing are the people whose parents talked about investing at the dinner table. Like they have a background in thinking about investing. They've been exposed to it at an early age. When you're a 14-year-old, you're not sitting around saying, okay, I want to be either a fireman or a doctor or a supply chain manager. Like you don't know the existence of supply chain management. You never think about it. You don't have a passion for it. No 14-year-old does, who also has friends. Mm-hmm. But it's a very important job. And as you grow through your career, you might realize that you have an aptitude for supply chain management. And then when you're in your 40s, you're one of the most valuable people in the entire company because of your supply chain management skills. If you only hired people with a passion for it, you would eliminate an enormous number of people who might be really good at it. And so I think it is not a prerequisite to bring in interns who have an obvious passion for investments. If they have the skills that I'm looking for, and they have, if their brain is thinking the right way about disparate topics, then I want to show them investing. And it's such a fun job that I'm expecting that they might develop the passion for it because it's a fantastic job. But like, that's on us to mm-hmm. to take super talented people and show them how great it is. And I know many, many people in the industry who disagree with me, and they view passion as one of the prerequisites for getting hired. And for an experienced person, I completely agree with that. But for a young person, I think you're cutting off a large group of candidates who might be great, many of whom, coincidentally, but not really because there's some correlation to it, they are in underrepresented demographics and maybe don't realize that this is a career that they can do incredibly well in and should get the opportunity to.
Yeah, it may be a great skill set, a great eventual passion of theirs, but they just have not been exposed to it yet.
Yep.
So because we just talked a little bit about identifying interns, let's dive into interviewing candidates. So as the director of research at two of really the best value investing firms, I imagine that you've conducted lots of interviews. In fact, I believe you were the director of research at Harris Associates when Alex Fitch and Michael Nicholas were hired. And I'm sure my listeners know that I interviewed Alex and Michael on the J. Rowe show just recently. They were excellent. And I consider them to be superstar analysts and portfolio managers now. So what do you look for in an interview? What are you trying to uncover from the interview process?
Yes, and I was the director of research when they were both hired. The identification of this talent comes from a disparate group of sources. Like I'm not just, if you give me a pile of resumes, 100 resumes, I can only tell you like the 15 worst. The other 85 all look good. Mm-hmm. And so I think it requires you to talk to people. And so, you know, last year I probably conducted 250 interviews. I probably interviewed 1,500 people, you know, since becoming director of research at Harris Associates in 2011. Wow. But a lot of that is because of my lack of ability to filter candidates until I talk to them. Mm-hmm. And so it's a huge part of my process to actually speak with the person. And so all of these people, Alex and Mike and the Harris people and then the Diamond Hill people, et cetera, get sourced from other people I know in the industry, from other coworkers, from recruiters that I might have on retainer, from, you know, and at the young level, from going to colleges and actually talking to groups and you know, the sourcing mechanism is relatively eclectic, and then it's really talent identification. Mm-hmm. You schedule the interview with somebody. You schedule it for 30 minutes if they have no experience, or 45 to 60 minutes if they have a fair amount of experience. And most of the time, after 10 to 15 minutes, you really regret how long you scheduled it for. Most of the time, you start excited with every one of them, and you get less and less excited as the interview progresses. And there you go. That's it. That's that. You know, if you're happy that a 45 to 60 minute interview has ended, you probably don't want to spend 25 years working with this individual. That doesn't mean they're not talented and passionate and have lots of, but you know what I'm saying here. Sure. Occasionally you finish a conversation and you're incredibly sorry that the time is up. And there's so many other things you want to ask, and you want to ask these questions organically. You're not going down a list. Just talking to them created a bunch of things that you're legit interested in. Why did they choose to do something a certain way? Mm-hmm. And that's a very good sign. Generally speaking, I'm looking for people who have an excellent ability to teach. And I assess that by their ability to speak in analogies. So they're explaining why they did something. And then they say, so it's kind of like, you know, in a basketball game, when this happens, you know, they'll give an analogy that's different than what they're talking about to help draw a parallel to a decision that they made in the past.
Yes.
That is evidence of pattern recognition skill, which is incredibly important in this industry. And so I can ask young, inexperienced students that have no investment experience all about decisions that they've made in the past, schools that they've gone to, extracurriculars that they've done, et cetera, just to kind of see if they are thinking in decision trees. And I don't know, it's I really enjoy it. I think it's great. And when you find, I'm excited every time I start an interview, and when you find somebody who's fantastic, it's totally worth it.
So when you have the initial conversation and you enjoy it and you want to talk to this candidate more, about how many, I don't know if we should call them rounds. How many rounds of interview do you think these candidates should have? And at the end, in the final round, once again, I don't know if round is the right terminology, but should the interview process conclude with a stock pitch delivered to the investing team?
So you have to think in terms of the barrier to exit for the person that you hire. You know, the barrier to exit to making a mistake with an intern that you hire is that 10 weeks later they leave. There, it's a tiny, tiny barrier to exit. And as long as over those 10 weeks, you know, they don't do something, they don't commit a crime at work or something like that, you basically can run the clock out, and therefore the hurdle for bringing them in is quite a bit lower. Because the exit is very simple. At the research associate level, you typically say this is going to be a 2 to 3 year position. You set the exit parameters up front. And again, it gives you the ability to take more flyers on the candidate. But, you know, I just hired a really great TMT analyst from First Manhattan via Dodge & Cox, who moved from New York City to Columbus with his wife.
Wow.
That is a very high barrier to exit. If you're bringing somebody in who is changing their entire life to work with you, you can't just take a flyer on that level of candidate. And
that
so,
makes sense. Yes.
And so the number of rounds is very correlated to the barrier to exit. In the case of an experienced analyst, yes, I mean, you're never going to have the confidence that they're the right candidate or not that you do after working with them for 6 months. You can't replicate working with them for 6 months in an interview process. So you do have to extrapolate what you're seeing and what you're hearing to how you imagine they will be at the firm. You want it to be a collective hire. You want many other people at the firm to feel as though they're stakeholders in this decision, so that they are rooting for the candidate when he arrives. You're never going to get unanimity, even with the very, very best people at Harris Associates, whom I hired, such as Alex Fitch and Michael Nicholas. There was not unanimity that they were great hires when they were brought in, but there was a preponderance of people believed that they were. And that's about as good as you're going to get in an interview process. So you collect all that data, and then you try to give the candidate as much information as you can about the job, because you don't want anyone to have seller's remorse, just like you don't want buyer's remorse. You don't want anyone to feel like, wait a minute, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. And so you want to be super transparent with them. In fact, I like to go through a process with each candidate and say, all right, you know, here's your offer, congratulations, and we celebrate for a minute. And then I say, okay, let me tell you the reasons why you might not want to take this offer. And let's do a pre-mortem on this. I'll be devil's advocate here. The things that I think that worry me are, you know, and then it'll be something about their personality relative to our culture or something about, and I just want you to know up front, I think that you're going to be fantastic here, but I want you to understand this so that you come in with your eyes wide open. I think it increases their chance for success when that happens. A stock pitch tends to be super informative. It's not always required, depending on the need and the candidate and how the interview process has gone thus far and the reference checks, et cetera. But for an experienced person, I think that you should err on the side of having them pitch a stock than not.
I can tell, I mean, you did 250 interviews just last year and, you know, 1500 in your career as a director of research. I can tell how this is a topic you believe to be very important and one that you think a lot about and one that you have probably built up a pretty unique way of doing this and a skill set in interviewing people.
Well, I mean, if you think about it, we were talking about how if you own a 50 stock portfolio, you need to know what the 51st best stock is.
Right.
I think a good director of research should always know the best available candidate who does not currently work at Diamond Hill. And just like you're assessing your 50th stock versus your 51st stock in a 50 stock portfolio, I think you should always, but you're taking into account tax considerations and frictional costs and other things like that when you're buying and selling stocks. As a people portfolio manager, you are doing the clients a disservice to not always know the person that you can pick up the phone and call if you need somebody. And you're not going to know that if you just sit at your desk and not interview people. Mm-hmm. It is fatiguing for a lot of people. A lot of people in this industry are introverts, and I completely get that. But I think that you're disadvantaged by only looking for people when you need someone. Because then the hurdle for hiring them is, can they do the job? Whereas when you don't need somebody and you're interviewing all the time, the hurdle is, how upset would I be if I didn't get to spend the rest of my career working with this person? That is a completely different hurdle. And that's the hurdle that all of your hires should be held to. So if you're only interviewing out of need, you're never going to use that hurdle. You're just going to look for somebody who can fill the seat and do a good job. But this is a tale of the bell curve industry. So you need better than that.
You're extremely thoughtful when, you know, whether it's talking about the tail of the bell curves, whether it's the hurdle you're looking for, whether it's thinking about this process through the lens of barriers to exit, you know, it's a fascinating topic to me. And, you know, I only know two of the people you've hired, and that's Alex and Michael. And what I can say about them is, I mean, as you said, preponderance of people thought that they were the right pick, and they were, and they both worked their way up to partner at Harris and portfolio manager of multiple funds, and Alex is director of research. But what I'd like to call out is both of them have taken hours, plural hours, out of their day to educate me on the side, as have you, and as have Bill Nygren. I've had conversations with all four of you offline multiple times, and you know, I think it speaks to the character, you know, of the people that you're hiring, especially with Alex and Michael, because, you know, they didn't need to do that. They didn't need to take hours out of their day on multiple occasions to educate me, but they did. And it's something I'll be forever grateful for.
So they're better analysts than I ever was. Like, I have determined that my skill set is more in talent evaluation necessarily than it is in stock picking, although I was a good enough stock picker to get where I got at Harris Absolutely. Associates. But when you're hiring people, when you speak about character, you want people who are going to root for their coworkers. There's two types of people who produce great work. One type wants to prove how smart they are. and the other type wants to earn the respect of the people that they're fortunate enough to work with. Yes. And both people are going to work really hard, and they're going to produce really, really good work. But one of them, everyone's going to root against and going to get very competitive with, and it's going to fracture the team. And the other one is going to help bring the team together because of the mutual respect. And so you do have to eliminate some very talented candidates sometimes because their motivation for being good is too self-centered, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. Yes. How do you spend the quiet time in your office? What are you reading? What's on your screen? Are you working on admin duties? How do you like to spend the quiet time in your office when you're not interviewing someone, when you're not on the phone, when you're not on a Zoom call, when you're not on, you know, in an investing team meeting or traveling for work? What are you doing?
Well, you just eliminated, by saying all the things that I'm not doing, you eliminated a lot of my time.
Okay.
There is, but I get the heart of your question. I will say that, you know, nobody ever grows up wishing they could be a director of research. You know, you want to be an analyst or a portfolio manager in this industry. There is a lot of bureaucracy and meetings, and, you know, you're the mortar between the bricks, and it requires you to do things to protect your talented investors from having to do them.
Yes.
Which, you know, it just is what it is. It's an important part of the job. So I'm just looking at the tabs on my computer right now. So I've got Carl Quintanilla's Twitter feed open. I think he generally retweets interesting and good links.
I love Carl's Twitter feed. He's always sending out, you know, whether it's good Wall Street research, whatever it is.
Or yes. Music, you know, whatever. Music, yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're right.
So yes. I've got it open. I've got Bloomberg and the Wall Street Journal open. I've got Crane's Chicago Business open. Something that I look at every day, I've got the New York Times obituaries page open. I think that the stories of people that I have never heard of who have passed away in other fields, it's kind of like reading a business book. You know, some really good business books are more interesting than investment literature. This you know, constantly updating, unfortunately, feed of obituaries actually has some very fascinating things in it, and I like to look at it. I've got Michael Mobison's latest piece open here. I always like to read what he puts out. I will say there is a repetition that comes with some of the very best writers in the industry. You know, you kind of know what Warren Buffett's going to say in his letter because you've read so many of his letters.
Absolutely.
And you could, you know, and Howard Marks is fantastic, but you also kind of know what Howard Marks is going to say. You know, I have reached the point in my career where I think there's more value to a disparate group of voices that are not necessarily, you know, value investing staples than 20 years ago in my career, where I devoured everything that those people wrote, and I should have. And people in their early 30s also should be doing that because their exposure to it is newer.
Well, that was a very disparate list of reading. What do you hope the Diamond Hill investing team looks like in 5 years? Do you envision it to be about the same size and structured the same way? Are there any incremental changes or improvements or adaptations you hope to put in place over time?
We have really great portfolio managers, which is a really good asset.
Austin has a very, very good, very reputable name in the industry.
Yeah, Austin Hawley is fantastic, and I would stack him up with anyone I've ever worked with as an investor, as a thinker. But we have a number of really good thinkers, investors here. The size of the team is about right. It feels large, but we are investing all the way down to small cap, and we're investing internationally as well. I would love to grow our international resourcing efforts coincident with our international AUM. I think two of my best analysts are on that product, and a great portfolio manager is on that product. The track record is really good. And we're just, I've put a lot of my own personal money into that product. We're just starting to grow it. And I think that it is a natural extension for our philosophy to go into somewhat less efficiently priced markets. And I would like nothing more over the next 5 years to resource them further as the product grows. I also think as a publicly traded company, diversifying our revenue streams towards international and fixed income will allow Diamond Hill investors to use a lower discount rate on our own cash flows. And so I think that is also important. But otherwise, you know, it's building the intern program, building the associate program. These things didn't really exist when I got here. And I am most proud of doing that at Harris Associates, and I'm replicating that here. You know, we had 260 applicants for 4 intern slots this summer. Wow. And everybody had to write multiple essays to get a slot. Like, this is going to be a powerhouse intern class. And that's what produces future Austin Hollies, like over a long period of time. And so I'm very excited about that engine over the next 5 years, even if from the outside, the numbers of employees and whatnot all feel kind of to be about the same.
I love that. When you've been doing this for a long time, what's the biggest investing lesson you've learned over the years?
I think that people should never be as confident as they are about their favorite investment idea as they are. I have seen again and again and again we all believe that concentrated portfolios are a good idea, but a single stock portfolio and the confidence that would be required to run that, I have seen people fool themselves by rooting for a name like that because they've gotten so mentally invested in needing to be right on that stock. And I think that you need enough shots on goal to be able to absorb mistakes. And so when you think about diversity within portfolio managers, I think that analysts need to have diversity within the new ideas that they bring, the types and sizes and styles of mispriced securities that they find, because I have been terribly wrong in my career on a few things that I was sure that I would be right on. And it's quite a lesson. You know, it's like you just suddenly discover that, you know, that gravity is optional or something. Like, and so the older I get, the less confidence I have. And I think that's actually the right way to develop. And so I try to, but the only way you learn that as a young person is to go all in on something that you're sure you're right on, and then have a really good retrospective afterwards on what happened relative to what you originally thought. Retrospectives are very important that way.
Last question, Wynn. I don't know many investors that think about investing process and the research process as much as you. I've been fascinated to learn more about Diamond Hill. Is there anything we missed or anything else you'd like us to know about Diamond Hill and its process and how the team is structured?
Well, I did mention, you know, putting a big investment into the international fund. That is a culture of ownership here. So when we're making investment decisions, we're making the decisions for ourselves as clients of these products, not just our other clients. And there's, again, it's a publicly traded company. There's a lot of share ownership here as well. And so the culture of doing the right things for clients and shareholders is very aligned with the 130 employees that we have here, which is great, honestly. And one really good thing about being a publicly traded company is you know, at many, many investment firms, all the profits are distributed at the end of the year, and you grow by taking share from somebody else. By being a publicly traded company, you can actually grow essentially by flexing your margins if you think about comp. And so you can make investments in the future via your income statement as opposed to via a trade-off with comp. And if a lot of people do well, a lot of people, you don't have to force rank the people. And so culturally, it's really nice. Like I know I'm advocating for the firm as an employee and as somebody who recruits to the firm, but I'm not doing it from a position of bait and switch. I genuinely think that they've structured something here culturally that aligns outcomes very, very well with clients and shareholders, and the employees are very happy with it.
I love that, Wynn. And thank you so much for coming on the J-Row show. I cannot put into words how much I have enjoyed this conversation and how much I have learned. You are truly an investing process whiz and master.
Thanks, John.
Before we sign off, I'd like to provide a quick reminder. Anything discussed on the J-Row show by myself or my guest is solely our own opinion and does not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. The J-Row show is for entertainment purposes only, so please do your own research on any securities discussed in this podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time.